Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to our lovely little show here, the Money Tree Investing Podcast. And we have an awesome interview with Christine Benz from Morningstar coming up. And my good friend, certified financial planner, Doug Goldstein, is going to take it over. But first, before we hand it over to him, have you ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all that online chatter, the millions of investors on social media? Well, your wait's over, because the same artificial intelligence techniques that are used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, that's now at your fingertips. Make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trading under ticker symbol BUZ, gives investors a portfolio of securities showing the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. There's no surveys, no guessing. Here's how it works. First, Buzz targets the most mentioned large-cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation about those stocks, well, the greater the reliability of the buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is then given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks with the most bullish score, those are the stocks that are included in the index. Every month, the Buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, and then the 75 companies with the most bullish score are again selected, positioning Buzz to capture the highest return potential. So invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. And I should also have a little disclaimer here. I own shares in the Buzz Index. It's great for me. Might not be great for you. Check it out first. moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. And now on to my good friend, Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Gelt.
I'm very excited to be talking to Christine Benz, who is the Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar and a senior columnist at Morningstar.com. She wrote a cool-sounding book called 30-Minute Money Solutions, a step-by-step guide to managing your finances. Christine, we don't actually have 30 minutes, but in about next 10, 12 minutes, let's see if we can cover a couple of things. And I think the first thing that a lot of people certainly ask me in my day job as a financial advisor, they go, oh, well, Morningstar likes that fund. They must know what they're talking about. They gave it 5 stars. Let's just buy only 5-star Morningstar funds. What do you say to someone like that?
Well, first of all, I say we're not the veggie burger people, because I sometimes hear that, oh, Morningstar, you guys are the veggie burger people. So not the veggie burger people. But there is a lot of confusion about this star rating that we have for mutual funds. The basic idea with the star rating is that it's designed to give you a quick snapshot of how a fund has balanced risk and reward relative to other funds that invest in the same way. It is not meant to be forward-looking. It's not meant to point you in the direction of the funds that will necessarily perform best in the future, because one thing that we know from evaluating investments and looking at funds, and you've probably seen this if you've seen ads on TV for mutual funds, past performance truly isn't very predictive of future returns. So right, you might look at it and say, well, this is kind of how a fund has done in the past, but don't use it as a gauge of a fund's worthiness going forward. You really need to do a little more homework than that.
But let's say that you have decided to buy a fund in a certain sector, for example, and you're going to decide between, you know, the 10 funds that do it, and some of them are 5-star funds and some of them are 2-star funds. You guys, it seems like, have already done the work. Wouldn't it just make sense to buy the 5-star funds? And I know, and I get your disclaimer that certainly it's not predictive, but comparing one fund to the other, isn't that kind of the point of the stars?
It's maybe a starting point for your research process. One thing to know, though, is that sometimes the funds that have had very strong returns in the past are also doing something a little riskier than their peers. Not always, but it's sometimes the case. So maybe they are investing a little bit more narrowly and focusing their bets a little more narrowly on fewer stocks. Or maybe they are packed into one little industry within that broader sector. So you need to understand what sort of risks the fund has taken to generate returns that are better than its peers. So take a look at that. And I do think that you need to look at the fundamentals of the fund as well. So one data point, while past performance isn't particularly predictive according to all of our review of the data, one data point that is, in fact, quite predictive is simply the expense ratio that you pay for that mutual fund. And I would reckon that this translates across borders, no matter where you're investing in the world, that if you can reduce your investment costs, you have a better shot of having a better experience, of finding your way to a better product. So we do.
Right, that
find,
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, we find expenses are really, really predictive. And it's counterintuitive because we all live in a world where you get what you pay for, right? If you spend more on a car, it's probably going to be a better car than if you really cheap out.
But well, I love my car, which is pretty cheap. Let me just touch on something you just said a minute ago because I just want to clarify. Again, and really, I want to move on to questions about planning for retirement.
Sure.
But I'd like to understand something about the way Morningstar does the research. Don't you build into the qualifications of or the into the study and the star rating of a fund, don't you build in the risk ratio? So if there was a mutual fund that only had two stocks inside but did really well, it would not get a five-star rating because it has such a high risk?
Yeah, that's a very good point and very true that the star rating does encompass risk. The problem is that a fund may have risks embedded in its portfolio that haven't shown themselves yet. So maybe a fund is taking some risky bets. They've paid off tremendously well, but they may come home to roost at some later date. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm saying it pays to kind of look at that portfolio, even though risks may have not whacked a fund in the past, they may come up and hurt it in the future. So take stock of what risks might lie within the portfolio.
Is there a tendency with the ratings, I'm presuming you've studied something like this, to have kind of a reversion to the mean? So if there's a fund that maybe was a five-star fund, you know, for a couple of years, it's likely to be a one- or two-star fund following that, so that eventually they all kind of average out?
Yeah, we do try to keep track of this, and oftentimes we do see exactly that pattern, where the fund may be riding high for a few years or even maybe a decade or longer, and then suddenly hit that market environment that is just not favorable for its style. Doesn't mean that it's a poor fund, but it does mean that even the best performers, even the best fund managers periodically mean revert. And so we see their performance drop back to average or even below average for various periods of time. So that's one reason we always encourage investors to make sure that they have a nice long time horizon for whatever investment that they're looking at. And also, if they are using some sort of a managed product, understand that even really good managers have these periods where they look terribly out of step with the market and may underperform their peers.
We're talking with Christine Benz from Morningstar. She's been talking to us about what the Morningstar structure is. So many people rely on the star rating. And one of the things I think that Christine is pointing out is that we shouldn't necessarily rely on that. It's one data point that people can use in making a decision about buying a fund, but it's certainly not the only one. Christine, a lot of people, when they're planning for long-term growth, they have the ongoing argument, which is, even if I buy five-star funds, the mutual fund industry and money managers don't always, not only do they not always beat the index, but they frequently, and the majority of times, they don't even beat the index. Why would someone spend so much time doing the research on the mutual fund industry if these funds aren't even beating the index? And should investors even look at mutual funds these days?
Well, one interesting trend that we've been monitoring has been a tremendous outflow from actively managed products. So mutual funds where there's an active stock picker at the helm, and maybe he or she is flanked by a bunch of analysts who are doing qualitative bottom-up research on companies or on bonds. One thing we've seen is this tremendous outflow from these actively managed products toward products that simply track a given market benchmark. So investors seem to be voting with their feet and saying, when I look at, and we certainly say this, when we look at the performance of the typical active fund, what we see is that the average active fund does not beat its index over time. I don't think that rules out the possibility that an investor can select a good active fund that will outperform over long periods of time, but certainly investors are looking at the data. They're quite compelled by the low costs of index products as well as exchange traded funds. So we see investors very much making that swap away from active stock pickers. A little bit less so on the bond side. We still see many investors casting their lots with active bond funds, but certainly on the equity side, dramatic outflow from active products.
Let's just talk for a second so that people understand the difference when you talk about an index fund and then you differentiate it between an exchange traded fund. What do you mean as the difference between the two?
The key difference is an index fund is like a traditional mutual fund in that the prices of the securities are totaled up just once a day. So there is one price for that mutual fund per day. You can't trade it intraday. So if you wanted to get out of a fund at 2 p.m., well, you'd have to wait until the end of the day, until all the prices of the portfolio were totaled up to be able to determine at what price you would be selling. An ETF or exchange-traded fund allows for that intraday trading. The prices are calculated throughout the day. And so it gives active traders a little bit more flexibility. Both types of products have very low costs on their side. So I typically say for investors, for long-term investors, which should be most individual investors in my view, an index mutual fund is going to do the job just as well as an ETF, in part because individual investors shouldn't value that ability to trade intraday. That probably would mean that they are trading a little bit too much than might be good for their health or wealth.
Yeah, I think people also have to realize that an ETF is a very broad term, and it stands for exchange traded fund. And although many ETFs simply track an index, meaning inside that basket, it might just be the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average or any of hundreds or thousands of other indices, it doesn't have to do that. An exchange-traded fund actually could have some strategy inside, and there could be a management system inside that's not just following an index. So you really need to look at what you're buying and don't just say, oh, I buy ETFs because, you know, I'm an index investor. That's not necessarily a true statement.
Absolutely. In fact, there's been an explosion of interest in the other type of index funds that you referenced that track specific factors, for example. So maybe they are looking to capitalize on the value effect or the momentum effect. So index funds can be created quite differently, ETFs as well, and they're not all market capitalization weighted index trackers.
Yeah, so I guess the moral here is to look really closely at what you're getting,
exactly.
Look at the fees that you're paying, and as we said, don't just rely on one factor. You know, Christine, I'm relying on you for a very, very good explanation of how the fund market works and the ETF market works, and I simply didn't have time to get to some of the very important things that I know you have a lot to add about planning for long-term investing, but maybe we'll have you back sometime soon. In the last few seconds, could you just tell people how can they follow you and follow your work?
Sure. My work is primarily on Morningstar.com, www.morningstar.com. And I write a few columns a week. I do a lot of videos for the website and focus specifically on the intersection between retirement portfolio planning and investment planning.
All right. Christine Benz, thanks so much for taking the time. Looking forward to having you back soon.
Thank you, Doug. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks a ton, Doug, for that awesome interview. We're about to hit the roundtable portion of today's show. But before that, ever wonder if there were a way to capitalize on all that online chatter of the millions of investors on social media? Well, there is one. The Buzz Index, trading under ticker symbol BUZ, is an index that follows the wisdom of crowds. We asked Jamie Wise from Buzz Index about what size companies he monitors. Is it all large cap?
We define large cap as 5 billion market cap or higher. There's two reasons why we'll focus only on large cap companies. First, the index has to be investable. There needs to be sufficient liquidity in the stocks that we want to invest in that all of our investors and stakeholders and advisors can rationally understand that they can commit capital to the product and that it won't affect the trading price of those underlying securities. The second reason we focus on the large cap universe is really to screen out for some bad actors, which are more likely to target very small cap and illiquid stocks in various online forums to try and manipulate the price behavior of those stocks. Very difficult to accomplish that in a large cap equity.
Well, it's interesting, Doug. You just talked to Christine Benz. I think that when you're investing, the size does matter, doesn't it?
Listen, in exactly the type of field that they're in, they have to be very worried that someone's going to manipulate or try to manipulate the index because that could have a huge effect on an investment. And I think that by dealing only in large cap stocks, they can, I don't know if completely, but they can pretty much completely eliminate the risk that, as he said, bad actors would come into play and try and weigh the odds unfairly.
Invest in the wisdom of the crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. And a disclaimer for me, I invest in the Buzz Index, but that doesn't mean it's right for you. Make sure you do your own homework. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. All right, Doug, Back to you, man.
Thanks so much, Joe. That was a really good description. Thanks for bringing Jamie on. Hey, Miranda, are you there with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. Miranda, tell me what's been going on with you.
just hanging out in Idaho. I'm on week 3 of my no travel month. It's very exciting because I've gone somewhere every month for the last year. And so having a no travel month has actually been pretty good. It's allowed me to kind of get my feet back under me, catch up on some things that have been neglected a little bit. And, you know, we're recording this just after tax day. So that's done.
Thank God we are done with taxes, and nothing like neglect when you think about who you're giving those taxes to. Hey, Linda P. Jones, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you, Doug?
I'm feeling pretty good. You are a world traveler, always out on a canoe or a catamaran or something. Well, you know.
A little bit bigger.
Yachting away, but not in the Mediterranean near me. Where are you going next on a big cruise?
I don't have a cruise planned, but I am headed to Seattle to get out of the heat for a little bit this summer. So I'm looking forward to going back to the old hometown.
Nice. And how's my guy, Joe Saul Sehy?
Well, it's fantastic. Miranda's hanging out in Idaho, and we call Texarkana our own personal Idaho. Like, we're out in the middle, out in the middle of nowhere, man.
Your own private Idaho?
Our own private Idaho. Nice, that's nice. Us.
Is that because you have preppers or what?
Moving on.
Right. So as you guys watch the B-52s flying overhead, here things in Israel are much more calm than that, although I've been getting a little pushback because on every episode of the Goldstein on Geld show, I am just so excited that my daughter got engaged that I always try to find some way to segue from a financial planning concept into, and of course, this is how we apply it to my daughter who just got engaged. So, hey, I just did it again. What do you know?
We're all very excited for her and for you.
Thank you. Assume you're flying us all to Israel for the wedding, right?
Didn't you get the ticket, Miranda?
I'm still waiting.
Oh, you just go check your mailbox now. Maybe it's there.
Tickets in the mail.
And while you are checking that for that mail, Miranda, let me ask you a question. When you're checking investments, one of the most common tools that people use are Morningstar ratings. In fact, for some people, it's kind of like the Bible of investing in the same way that Linda has her Bible, which I won't mention now.
What?
Did you look at... No, I'm kidding. You like Investor's Business Daily. That's your thing.
Oh, well, I wouldn't call it a Bible. But...
All right. A guide. Is Morningstar, Miranda, do you think just a guide, or do you think it's actually a really substantial tool that people should be using?
I think it's a pretty good tool that people can use if they're doing some research into, you know, what there is out there, especially for funds. I think it's a really great tool to get an idea of what to expect from a fund and to see whether it might fit into your own investing strategy. I haven't used it much personally. I like to check it out every now and then just to kind of get an idea of where some of my funds stand. But with the indexing strategy I use, I don't really need to check in all that much. But I do think it can be a very valuable tool. And it's worth noting that Morningstar also has a stock screener, so you can look up individual stocks as well as funds.
Yeah, they actually have a lot of good tools on their site. Joe, Miranda spoke about using Morningstar to kind of get a feeling of the expectation for a fund, but the Morningstar people themselves say not to use it to predict a fund. So are they just saying that because they need their lawyers tell them to say that, or do you think it's true?
No, I think it's totally true. You know, when I got away from looking at Morningstar to guide me to the future and instead guide me to what she talked about, which I think is the important part of Morningstar, being able to look at risk versus reward, right? I love Morningstar for that particular reason. The last thing I try to look at is the star ranking. I wish it was a little bit hidden, because what I found myself doing is going into Morningstar, looking at the statistics about risk that it takes, then looking at the returns versus the index that they say that it best connects with. You know, everybody says, Doug, they want to beat the market, but what's this fund really designed to compete against? And I really like that. So as an example, if I find a fund competes against the S&P 500, but then I find that historically it takes about only 70 or 75% of the risk of the S&P 500, but it gets beat by the S&P by only, you know, let's say it delivers returns of, let's say, 90% of the S&P 500. Well, then I have a fund that is going to give, at that time, my client a much smoother ride because they're a little risk adverse. It's going to get beat by the S&P 500, but historically, the returns versus the risk was well worth it. So I can kind of look at the weather report of where that's going to head, even though I can't predict returns.
Mm-hmm. I think risk versus reward is the key to the whole investment decision process, because all the time there are investments that did do great or that are going to do great. And if people are always striving for that, they just neglect to look at the potential risk. And what you're pointing out is that Morningstar is a good source for that. Linda, do you use Morningstar as a tool to look at risk or return?
I think Morningstar is an interesting tool, but it's really a tool of looking in the rearview mirror. And that's really the only indication it can give us, is what funds were the best performers in the past. And the reason I say that is Vanguard did a study, and they found that actually the funds that were rated 1, 2, or 3 stars perform better than the 5-star rated funds over the next 3 years. So in terms of a forward-looking indicator, it's not a great forward-looking indicator. It's a perfect backward-looking indicator.
Well, maybe it is. Just buy the 1, 2, or 3-star funds, and then you'll do better over the next, right? Isn't that, if you just do the exact opposite of what you would think, maybe that's what you're saying.
I think based on what Linda's saying, I think that Morningstar sometimes, Christine didn't market Morningstar this way, but when people talk to each other about what Morningstar does, they always focus on those star rankings. Listen, I think the star ranking is the last thing on Morningstar that I like, because exactly what Linda says, it just shows you what happened. That's why I like the statistics. If it's an active fund, I like being able to see the management turnover. I can look at the expenses, which Christine dug into the expenses of one fund versus another, even passive funds. I can compare two different passive funds and look at the expense ratio and the risk level. So I think those are the great things about Morningstar. I think if an investor learns to use Morningstar and ignore that star rating, I think they're going to do a much better service to themselves.
Yeah, and I think Christine pretty much mentioned that herself. But, you know, also I think, Joe, just to piggyback on what you said about expense ratio, that is so important. You know, William Sharp, the founder of the Sharp Ratio, said all other things being equal, the smaller a fund's expense ratio, the better results obtained by its stockholders. Yeah. So I think Morningstar can help us with that.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify, when I talk about expectations, I'm talking about all that stuff, your expectation for expense ratio, your expectation for comparison, your expectation for what you think, you know, what you can expect from the fund as a whole. I'm not talking specifically about the star rating and the future. I'm talking about your expectations for the fund once you like dig in there and you can look at the data.
Does your cynical side, Miranda, make you sometimes say, you know, all of these rating agencies, not just Morningstar, but, you know, you look at S&P and Moody's and Fitch, these guys who try to rate things, does it make you wonder that maybe they're just really good at marketing themselves as rating agencies, but they're not necessarily adding value? You know, Morningstar, as Joe and Linda are pointing out, don't look at the star ratings, and you know, S&P, don't look at the AAA ratings. These guys have gotten it wrong in the past. How much weight do you think we should give their opinion on an investment when we know they say you can't count on it, or you can't necessarily bet on it, and they've been wrong enough times in the past that it kind of makes you wonder?
Well, and one of the things that we learned, right, we learned looking back and looking at the financial crisis, is sometimes the ratings are outright bought. Sometimes the ratings are given. I mean, sometimes the ratings are given just so that people will keep using the ratings. Using their ratings, you know, what are they talking about? Like, well, if you're not going to give us this great rating, if Fitch won't give us this rating, then we'll go to S&P and get a better rating, or we'll go to Moody's and get a better rating, and then we'll put that on our site. And so, yeah, part of it is a big marketing thing. I think that the real tool comes in where the data is collected together and the research is collected together, so that you don't have to go looking to a lot of different sites or try to find that data or try and tease the data out of the reports that the company itself put out or that the company's required to file. So the nice thing about something like Morningstar is that you can go to one place and you can kind of dig into the numbers and the research is laid out in a way that's sometimes a little bit easier to digest than what you would get from just a blanket filing. And so, yeah, so from that standpoint, it's like the ratings themselves probably don't mean a lot. But if you're doing the research and you want to dig into the numbers and figure out, okay, what are my reasonable expectations for this? And does it fit into my portfolio? Then, yeah, I think it can be a great place to start and a great place to go find that information.
And that's the truth about using any of these tools like Morningstar. I think
a lot of
investors want it to be easy. And so, hey, if I can just get my stars and then go eat my lunch, I pick a fund. That's great. It ain't going to be that easy. If you're really doing your job, you're digging in far more, like you're talking about, Miranda.
Yeah, and it's really showing the past performance. I mean, that's really its purpose, right, is to give us the rearview mirror. So it's not, I don't think it's meant to be predictive. I think Christine herself said, you know, be very careful about using it to be predictive of the future. It's really, it's merely just looking in the rearview mirror at the past and what's happened and what has gotten us to this point. But, you know, the game of Wall Street is to print out, you know, all the five-star funds and say, look what a great, perfect portfolio this was. And the question is, well, did all your clients own that?
A lot of money managers will do is they'll buy right before the end of a quarter, they'll buy a few stocks. They can say, oh, yeah, I held that stock this quarter that did very well, even if they, in fact, didn't hold it for the whole quarter.
And they need that window dressing because, as we've talked about, it can only do past performance. And it doesn't matter what you're doing or where you're looking or how you're looking at things or whether you use, you know, whether you use charting or whatever it is you're using. The only thing you have to go on is past performance because the future isn't here yet. And so you have to kind of. That's right. So now, I mean, you do. And now immediately the future that we just arrived at is now the past.
That's so surreal. Okay, the Money Tree Surreal Podcast.
But that's the that's the thing, and that's the thing that you have to realize when you start investing is you have to make the best decisions you can based on the information that you have and the information that has been compiled, because we don't know what's going to happen. We can't predict the future, and we can do our best to project into the future and look for trends and look for things that we think might happen and try and figure out, you know, what the leader of the free world is going to do next. But the bottom line is we don't know any of these things. And so we have to make decisions based on the information that we have.
But you can do that in conjunction with using certain other things that explain why some of that performance happened. For example, if we know that interest rates peaked in 1982 and they've been coming down all these years and they bottomed last July, then we can say, okay, we understand, we understand why the bond market has had this tremendous track record. And when you look in the rearview mirror and it's averaging 18% a year, let's say, or 15% a year, some astronomical number, you can say, okay, that's because interest rates were falling. And so it had this wind under its wings that was helping its performance. Now, because we're in a rising interest rate market, does that mean long-term bonds are going to do the same thing for the next 20 or 30 years? I don't think so. So you have to, you know, I think it's important to also understand where some of that performance came from and why it performed the way it did.
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, I definitely agree with that. It's just, it's still all in the past and it's still, and we could still kind of make those correlations. But in the end, something new could happen in the future that nobody's prepared for.
Yeah, I'm just saying sometimes people look at, you know, performance and then they go, oh, wow, look at bonds. I mean, they're the place to be because look at the performance for the last 20 years on bonds. And it's like, well, what's the chance that that's going to repeat in the next 20 years? Zero. So
that's true.
Know, people need to really, you know, add a little bit of understanding to the performance and to the star ratings.
Right. That's like when people call me up and they say, hey, Doug, how's the market doing? What do you mean by it's doing? You want to know how's it gonna do? And just to tell you where it's at right now doesn't really make any difference to how you might invest. I think that, Joe, I want to touch on something you mentioned a little bit earlier, which was that a tool like Morningstar can be packed with information. And relating what you said to one of the things that I thought Christine said and what we discussed in the interview was that maybe we give a little too much credit to people about their ability to really understand investing. And I don't want to knock anyone because I think that everyone's trying. Even, you know, even a guy who's a professional, I've been doing this for decades. I'm also always trying to learn. But, you know, just an example of whether people think an ETF is an index fund. You know, people will use those two terms interchangeably and they don't, you know, necessarily even understand that they're not the same thing or what a mutual fund is. Has that been your experience that maybe we need to go back to some really basic education so people know what they're getting involved in?
It's so hard not to use jargon when you've been investing for a long time. But I think that that's a big problem the whole industry faces is that, you know, I remember the first time that people started talking to me about BIPs And I'm in this room. I'm a first-year financial planner. I got my tie on, and everybody's talking about 30 bips and 20 bips and 50 bips. And I sit the entire meeting, and everybody else is commenting, and I'm like, what the hell's a bip? I got no idea. So I think sometimes
we take... So now you have to tell our audience what a bip is.
Those are basis points. So if something's 50 bips, that means it's half of 1%. 30 bips is 30 basis points, which is 0.3%. Is that fair, Linda?
That's good.
That's amazing how quickly you could look that up on Google, Joe.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing with ETF versus mutual fund, right?
Like, the information's there. You just got to actually know what to look for.
Yeah, but I agree. It's tough. I think a lot of people don't understand that. I was interviewing a gentleman from BlackRock, and he was talking about how still investors are kind of confused about exchange traded funds. They know that it's the buzzword now, right? It's the sexy way to invest money, but it's still very confusing.
All right. Well, let's hope that people are a little less confused after our conversation today. But one of the ways that we could help to clarify it is to tell them where they could go to find out about what we're doing. So, Linda, let's start with you. Tell us what is going on in the world of Linda P. Jones.
Well, since you gave me a bad time about cruising, I'm going to mention a podcast I did about cruising. I talked about a true story of two groups of people who went on the same cruise and had the same budget, but vastly different experiences in terms of what they were able to get, what they were able to do, and how far they were able to stretch their money. So it's kind of a fun podcast, number 253 on Be Wealthy and Smart. Right. At lyndapjones.com.
Sounds great. I'm actually looking forward because I keep thinking I'm going to go on a cruise one day, and I want to know how to do it right. Miranda, what's going on?
Oh, yeah.
What's going on in the world of planting money seeds?
Yeah, so we'll have something up on planting money seeds about the ways that people manage money differently depending on their socioeconomic class growing up. So there's some pretty interesting data that looks at the way people manage money if they were raised like in the upper middle class versus lower middle class, or if you have it or if you were raised in the working class, and kind of the way that shapes how you feel about money and the way it shapes how you actually manage money later in life.
Oh, that sounds great. Hey, Joe, you know, I noticed that the image on Stacking Benjamins now has this funky picture of you and some guy with a bag over his head. What's going on in Stacking Benjamins?
Right. That's OG, my co-host, goes by the other guy. And so we leave the bag over his head for privacy reasons. And I think it might give you a little bit better idea of what the show is all about or not about.
I love that picture.
Erin Lowry, a friend of ours, BrokeMillennial.com. She is wicked smart, has written this great book called Broke Millennial, and it's amazing. So we talked to her about some lessons from the book Broke Millennial to not be so broke anymore.
Well, that sounds great. Good not to be broke, as many millennials unfortunately are. Well, at the Rich as a King website and podcast, I actually just wrote a blog because a lot of people who are very concerned about the incredible height of the stock market are looking for something else to do. And one of the common things that they get that gets marketed to people is you should buy real estate because it never goes down, which of course is not true. But I talk about on the Rich as a King podcast episode 135, how you can invest in real estate but not actually be a landlord, which you can find at richasaking.com.
Awesome.
All right. I think that wraps it up for us today. Miranda, could you take us out?
Make sure you visit us at moneytreepodcast.com and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. And if you like what you've heard, leave us a review. We love seeing the reviews. We love hearing what you have to say about us. Good, bad, ugly, whatever. Leave us a review on iTunes and Stitcher. And also don't forget to ask us your questions. Send us your questions. We recently completed a listener question episode, and we'll have another episode sometime in the relatively near future. So if you have a question and for some reason you want our input on that, go ahead and send in your questions. And remember, no one cares about your money as much as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.